I would like to submit that, especially in those questions, maybe the giver of your existence or the giver of your faith or the center of your faith is the one kind of leading you in that curiosity. Maybe this is, maybe what the question is an invitation from the divine to go on a journey to be transformed.
Welcome, you wonderful, purposeful, and beautiful humans to Hope Still Wins. I'm your host, Ben Higgins. Hope Still Wins is a place where we get to know thought leaders from diverse backgrounds and differing worldviews to help us feel less alone, more connected, and move us to become a better world together. Ultimately, answering the question, does hope still win? If so, why? And if not, why not? And right now, we are in the middle of a series where I have the honor of interviewing incredible humans to see how hope has played a role in their story when life takes an unexpected turn. From life-altering diagnosis and adversity to loss of a loved one, bankruptcy and beyond, we're going to cover it all. In today's episode, we're lucky to be able to learn from my new friend, author, artist, and performance speaker, Scott Erickson. Scott recently came out with his new book, Say Yes, Discover the Surprising Life Beyond the Death of a Dream, which I highly recommend you to go out and read right now, today. In this episode, Scott and I dive into this book, the theories and philosophies he has around how you continue to move forward in a life of comparisons. If you're somebody out there right now who struggles with comparison, I think you'll enjoy listening to this podcast. Well, I won't pause any longer. It's time. Let's jump into it. On this episode of Hope Still Wins, here is my conversation with the Scott Erickson. Scott, thank you so much for joining Hope Still Wins.
Love being here. I'm glad I'm here.
You're one of those people who, in the different groups and rooms I'm in, your name gets brought up a lot. And so I'm glad we're finally, well, I guess I'm glad I'm finally getting to meet you on this podcast.
I love it. Wow. What are these rooms?
These are random rooms, mostly with people.
Random rooms.
Mostly with people that are feeling a deep level of dissatisfaction or pain and hurting and going, you know what? You should read this book. You should read Scott's book, or you should talk to Scott, listen to his story. Which I would take that as a huge compliment if that's where people's minds went.
Absolutely. I think so. Yeah. I have a superpower of being too honest, I guess. Like I have a lot of questions and want to go after the answers. And so thankfully there's a lot of other people who feel the same way. So,
you know, when we started this project, this podcast, I guess is probably just a more simpler way to say it. That was really my desire. I feel like I've lived my whole life asking a million questions, not having very little answers. And the only way I ever felt better about my questions was a community to at least ask the questions to.
Yeah.
That's where this comes from. So I want to get started by just allowing you a few moments here to introduce yourself. For anybody that's unfamiliar with the work that you do, we're going to dive into that as we continue to talk. But if I was to ask you a question, who are you? In the best way you can, how would you answer it?
Yeah, I spend my time focused on, besides being a family man and a husband, father, all that, and an adventurer, my work looks like being an artist. When I say that to people, usually a blank face appears on them and they're like, I don't know what that means. So as an artist, I kind of have like three areas that I focus on. One is I'm an illustrator and a painter. So I make work like that, sell it. I'm an author and hope to continue exploring that medium. And then I'm a performing artist, which means I do these kind of weird events in front of people. I'm not a performing artist as much as doing like abstract work or getting naked in front of people. Although I'm not saying that's not down the road for me, but not right now, I keep my clothes on. So those kind of three things is what I spend my time doing. And usually they're all kind of tied in together. There'll be some kind of idea or question, like we're talking about, or thing I want to explore, and I'll explore it visually and then performance wise. And then how does this become like some kind of artifact, like a book or something like that? So it all kind of ties in together.
Are these questions and mostly around the idea of God and something greater, or are they just other questions even outside of that?
Yeah. I mean, I think all kind of questions eventually lead to, I guess, like an existential conversation where we would talk about the divine or the almighty. In fact, like this book and this work, I remember at a time in my life, I went through a real severe burnout that led to a long season of depression with some suicidal ideation. And one of the things my therapist said is I needed to develop like a physical activity, some kind of practice, you know, like running or working out, some going on walks, something to, you know, depression, it really helps when you get in your body and kind of get out of that. But I remember being on a run and going, I do feel better, but why the hell am I running? Like what, like for what, you know? So even though we might have these like mental health practices or things, I do think that tied into that, maybe below the surface, maybe it takes us a while to get to, we have a deeper conversation that we're having with existence. And if there's a giver of that existence, we're having a conversation with that giver. And that's how I kind of view the things. I don't always have to start with the giver as much as I think eventually we touch upon the giver. And that is what I'm interested in. I am a person of faith. And so it just is part of what I do and think about and want to help create. I want to make something that's really honest for people. I have spent a lot of my life in, you know, organized religion in those aspects. And I still have some of those frameworks for the tradition that I'm a part of, but really I just see myself as a seeker, and I have questions about life and about death and about why we're here and what we're doing here and what should we do here and what is the best way of doing here and how come there's so many absurd moments about being here. These are the things that I ponder as an artist, and so I am in that conversation, I guess, with the divine, the giver of our existence, about what it means to be here. And I can't get away from it. You know what I'm saying? Like I'm always kind of secretly like, gosh, I wish I could just talk about other stuff. yeah.
Is the book that you referenced, Say Yes? I just want to make sure for people out there, Say Yes by Scott Erickson. It is going to be the framework for our conversation today. You have, some incredible projects out there, some incredible pieces of art through your writing. A friend of mine, as I mentioned before he came on here, Michael, who has been on this show before, he follows your book on Advent. But today we're going to talk about Say Yes, and I couldn't feel more comfortable in this conversation because I've desired this conversation to exist on this podcast for so long. And this might totally derail us, but we'll get back. You mentioned an existential crisis that you had. You mentioned that you have worked in organized religion for many years of your life. You now mentioned that a lot of your work is around asking questions. And the first question I want to ask is, have you found it lonely to ask these questions so often?
I mean, I think some places are afraid of asking those questions. Look, I think when we get, and let me clarify, I have been a part of organized religion. I have been on staff as like a pastor or as a director, creative director, things like that. But that's only been for a few years. I'm a trained spiritual director, which is kind of like a soul guide that is alongside other leaders and stuff like that. So I do have this training, but I think to ask questions is for some people it's scary because they have for organizations because they have mortgages and staffs and bills to pay, And so sometimes asking tough questions can be very scary to what you've set up and built up. And I can say, you could also bring that to an individual. You could set up your life in a way where you're like, all of this is holding together. It feels a little teetery, but I just got to hold it all together or it's all going to fall apart. Like I remember having a conversation with a relative about certain things about the Bible or whatever. And she's like, well, if one thing's incorrect, the whole thing's incorrect. And I was like, if that's what you've built, that's easily going to fall apart on any subject matter, you know? And so for me, I think, yeah, the questions can threaten the framework we've set up for us, but it's infinitely better to go into those questions because it causes us to have curiosity, bringing attention to it. It allows us to be transformed by what we may find. And I would like to submit that, especially in those questions, maybe the giver of your existence or the giver of your faith or the center of your faith is the one kind of leading you in that curiosity. Maybe what the question is an invitation from the divine to go on a journey to be transformed. That has been my experience. And so when people enter into tough questions, I'm like, I don't think you're alone in this. I actually think there's some kind of providence alongside you on this journey.
What freedom have you felt then? You know, I am a Christian.
Yep.
I grew up in the Midwest.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. the idea of questions, the idea of things falling apart, the statement that you just made, that if one interpretation, if one thing in the Bible is not true, then the whole thing comes down around it, scares the bejeebus out of me as a kid. The idea that there were so many questions in my head and so many people telling me 1,000 different things, even within my own practice, scared me as a kid. When I started asking the questions, when I started seeking, there is a beauty that comes with that. And so I want to ask you, I want to throw it to you, what freedoms then have you found in asking these questions and encouraging others to ask the questions as well?
I think that, let me give it in a framework of like a story. Why it's incredibly hard to be any kind of like priest or pastor or clergy. One of the things that's difficult, and not all communities are like this, but often a community wants to hire a person to be a certain way for their entire existence. They like hire them and they're like, great, we like you how you are. We'd like you to stay this way for 30 years. And that's impossible because nobody stays the same over 30 years, even 5. You know what I'm saying? Everybody's on kind of a journey. And so what happens often is in like spiritual direction, working with leaders, is that a leader will find themselves so far beyond where they started, but the community wants them to be that same person they were 17 years ago. So let's take that out of that specific thing. I think that whether at some point you, bought in or not bought in, but like said yes to a certain kind of framework or a certain kind of religious belief, I'm guessing as you continued on your life, stuff happened. Like your heart was broken. You saw intense poverty. You had a friend die. You went through an illness. A loved one died of cancer. You got bankrupt. You went to jail. I don't know. I know lots of people who've gone through all of these things. Something adds to the depth and dynamism. Is that the right word? Dynamic life that we find ourselves in. And what we end up throwing out is the simplistic faith structure that we've tried to keep the whole time. That eventually you come to a point and you're like, gosh, this isn't even applied to my life anymore. This was kind of my meditation on Advent. You referenced this Advent book that I made because I looked at Christmas, which I love, but I looked at the brand of Christmas and it being celebrated in the midst of a complex, crazy, insane world. And I was like, does this have any hope for the world? Or is this just like a distraction from the reality we find ourselves in? And I kind of feel the same way about your kind of anybody's spiritual journey is like, you are going on a journey. And as you go along, your structure, or I'd like to say your practices, the way you want to respond in the world, your practices are going to need to adapt and grow as you start to interact with the very dynamic and deep and broad and weird, absurd, mysterious world that we find ourselves in. So my faith would have gone a long time ago if I didn't allow myself to have some kind of growth in that area. And so now where I find myself is like, I'm a lot more open-handed with mystery, with knowing and unknowing. A really helpful framework for me, which I picked up from the Quaker leader, Parker Palmer, who's a great writer and stuff like that. He's like, at the core of the Christian faith is a paradox, which is a paradox is two seemingly opposite truths existing at the same time. He's like, Jesus is a paradox, supposed to be God and man at the same time. And a paradox is nothing that can ever be solved. A paradox is something you enter into to be transformed by. Hmm. And so him kind of allowing that unsolvable paradox, it really helped me to go, it's not necessarily something I have to completely figure out as much as something I can enter into and be transformed by. And let's pay more attention to what's being transformed in me by entering into the paradox. And so that's kind of like why I've kept with it, because I still find myself in the paradox of it all, of like, at times going, this is the truest thing I've ever heard. And then at sometimes going, this is complete fiction and a fantasy tale that I'm telling myself. And like, to think that I would have either one of, or would only have one of those is untrue to the human experience. We actually know that we often just have both of those things in us at all times. And so it's making amends with that paradox. That really helped me in my own journey, is to live in the paradox, and that's where the transformation happens.
Which is why I asked the question. Is it lonely mm-hmm. to ever ask these questions? Mm-hmm. Because living within the paradox, asking the questions, they're inevitably, and you see it in the messaging, at the start of that process, there's a million voices coming in saying you're no longer going to belong because you don't know what's going to be ripped away. You don't know how you're going to change. You don't know how God is going to interact in your life and in your world. You don't know what pains are coming about. And we can all agree on the simple terms. We can all speak about it and share about it. We can all agree on these simple terms. But if those simple terms even start to fall apart, where are you going to go? And so my question for you is, kind of going back to the question before, when people enter into this, where do they mm-hmm. go? Where do they turn? How do they belong? How do they know that they belong?
When we get into belonging is such a, it's a wonderful and important, and it's the best conversation. I would say there's a few things. One is, and this is from my experience being in my mid 40s and on my own journey. And I talk about this a bit in the book Say Yes, when we get into the idea of living in a culture of comparison and how we can be a contribution. One of the things I think is really important is that we discover, now you got to understand that this hits all the bells and whistles in me from my upbringing, but I found that it's really true, is that the journey to knowing God is the journey to knowing yourself. What I mean is that if a writer a long time ago named John said that God is love. So love, if you can imagine like a pitcher and then a cup, love is that pitcher. Love wants to pour itself out into you, but you can't receive love if you secretly hate the cup that love made you to be. Because this is the only container, your incarnation, your life is the only container you've been given to receive love in. And if you're trying to constantly trade it out or change it up, like compare and get rid of it, then love is always going to fall flat. So from my experience, is like when I owned the gift of my own existence, when I said, I'm thankful that I'm alive. I'm thankful that I'm me. Sure, there's probably things I'd like to change. That's probably because of mass marketing. But like, I'm glad to be me, and I received the gift of me. That was the journey to receiving, to experiencing the love of God. So, because I can't experience God outside of my own life. So all that to say is like, usually when we get to belonging, the conversation of belonging is it's in the receiving the gift of yourself. I would say that, and this is where we could talk about identity work, is off through kind of at the beginning of our life, we were working for identity. And then there, when we can come to the centering place, then we work from identity. And that's a very different transformative spot. So I think there's a doorway to belonging that's inside of you, and that's receiving the gift of yourself. And that's where God wants to meet you. Then I also think that there is this long tradition and history of women and men who've been on the same journey. They've written about it. They left, you know, we could, they've left poems about it and songs about it. We can find their artifacts of the journeys they've been on. This is what art history is in a lot of ways. These songs, meditations, poems, they have written about their own journeys coming to try to understand what it means to belong in the world, to belong to yourself, to belong to the divine. And we can find a community through that in the history and in the tradition that we're a part of. And then I think we also can just find the thirdly, we're going to find it with people who are around us today. I have come up, this is also in the book, man, so many book plugs right now, but like I have this little meditation that I do, and this really helped me, which is I think that inside of us, when we can start to connect, how do we connect with a divine presence in our life? I think that there's two graces that we have. A grace is something you've never asked for. It's just something that's been given to you. So the first one is something to do with your body. If you can find your heartbeat, like find it in your chest or your neck or your pulse on your arm. If you just spend time with that heartbeat, you'll realize that what is keeping you alive is something that's you're not in charge of. There's actually something that's happening inside of you. The only reason you're here is by something that you're not in charge of. And so we could say, well, that's part of who I am, be human. Sure, but it's also like a grace. You didn't go to a place to get your heart. It was given to you. It's always been with you. It's what keeps you alive. And same with like our breath. And then you could even take it farther to like the orbit of the planet, where it is around the sun. There's so many things that we're not in charge of that are keeping us alive. So we have all these graces around us. So we have this like physical grace, but then I think we have the spiritual grace, which is this. If you who are listening, you can just do this, but just I simply like talk to God, like say a prayer. You don't even have to say it out loud. Actually, don't use your voice at all. Emote it with your very being. You have this capability of communicating with God. How did you get that ability? Did you ever have to go somewhere? Did you have to go to a shrine or a store or anything to pick it up? No, it's always been there. And I like the image I give it is of like a telephone. Like you have a telephone in you. Somehow you have like a portal, a doorway, a telephone to talk to the divine. So like you have one, I have one, everybody listening has one. And then what I ask is go in the history of religion and evangelism and missions work, all this stuff. Often religion has said, we need to go to these people and we need to put telephones in them, which is ridiculous because you can't put telephones in people. They're already in there. So what if we move from thinking that we have to do anything like bring telephones to people? Maybe what we do throughout our lives at an appropriate time, you know, right off the bat, it's a little uneasy, but when we get to know people, we go, hey, do you ever have phone calls? What are your phone calls like? Like, because you cannot answer the phone that's inside of you. That happens for sure. Ego, fear, all kinds of things. But again, I think when we can, if you walk around the world and you're like, everybody has a telephone already, they're already having conversations. Maybe I can discover something about my own journey through the other journeys that people are going on too. And that might lend and help lead me into this identity of belonging. So I would say like you have something in you, a place, other people have it. And then we have this tradition of women and men who've gone before us in that too. And those things can bring us into the community of belonging.
I'm telling you right now, Athletic Greens has been one of the greatest things for my life. In fact, my brother-in-law was just in town a few days ago, and he had mentioned how great Athletic Greens are. I love Athletic Greens. In fact, they are high in vitamins, minerals, whole foods, superfoods, probiotics, and adaptogens. I just mix it with a glass of water every morning. When I first wake up before my workout, I mix Athletic Greens with my water. I drink it on the way to my workout, and I know I'm getting my day off
to a great start. It's honestly lifestyle friendly. Whether you eat keto, paleo, vegan, dairy-free, or gluten-free, it is the best thing for you. It contains less than 1 gram of sugar, no GMOs, no chemicals or artificial anything, and it still tastes good. I think it tastes like chocolate, honestly. It's like a chocolate drink every morning. And here's a great part. It costs less than $3 per day. All right. If you aren't convinced by now, I think you should be, because it's time to reclaim your health and arm your immune system with convenient daily nutrition, especially heading into the flu season and cold season. It's just one scoop and a cup of water every day. That's it. No need for a million different pills and supplements to look out for your health. To make it easy, Athletic Greens is going to give you a free 1 year supply of immune supporting vitamin D and 5 free travel packs with your first purchase. All you have to do is visit athleticgreens.com/HSW. Thank you for supporting Athletic Greens. Thank you for supporting Hope Still Wins. It means a ton to our team. Again, that is athleticgreens.com/HSW to take ownership of your health and pick up the ultimate daily nutritional insurance.
You mentioned the Bible and how many stories. I mean, if you know, so many people that are listening are going to read the Bible or be familiar with the Bible. How many stories of their individual journeys, and questions and confusions and cries.
Yeah.
And you start looking at the Bible that way. How much more beautiful is it? It's a collection of people on a very similar journey to what we are. The practices, and yes, you gave a couple of book plugs, which I'm really happy about. And we'll continue to, at the beginning of this episode, at the end, talk about the work that you've done. Yeah. We've talked about some of these practices. You just went through a few of them for us. Why are mental health practices and spiritual practices so similar, but so essential for our life and for our lives to thrive?
Yeah. That's a great question. And I'll reference that one about the running, like, hey, working, you know, developing a physical routine is very helpful for your body and your psyche, but then also it ties into kind of this like soul or spirit that's also in you. We are this like amalgamation of body and spirit. And Oprah taught us that. So when I say spiritual practices, it can be a number of different things. It's sometimes the narratives you say yourself, and then they can be very physical actions that you do. You know, like whether it's like, when I meet people, I always smile and let them know I'm welcoming, you know, something like that. For me, and a lot of this, my story, the show and the book is about realizing I came to like not a dead end, but really I was like, I know I want to go somewhere else and I don't know how to change and I don't know how to transform, but I want to move forward. And I was confronted by these arguments, the voice of giving up. And so I had to figure out a way to counteract these arguments. And so my practices that I mentioned in the book are really about like counteracting these arguments. And what I would say they mostly are is they're reframing the narrative of where I think I'm at and what I think I'm doing. So we have, and I've run this by, I'm not a therapist, I just go to therapy, but I've run this by a bunch of psychologists. And like our most predominant narrative we have in our life at all times is, am I safe or not in this moment? It's happening all the time. You know, if you're listening to this, you probably feel comfortable or whatever, but if like immediately you moved into a neighborhood or a situation or a room where you weren't familiar, like your senses would let you know, like you got to be on guard. Like it's just, am I safe or not? It's just something that's always happening all the time. Now we also have these narratives that are happening all the time, and they're a bit more insidious, but they sound like this. They go, this is who I am. This is what I'm capable of doing. And this is how my life is going to turn out. And those narratives are working all the time too. They were formed in us when we were kids and we learned how to survive in the world, when we learned how to interact like with adults and what adults told us, especially our parents. And they're affecting us all the time too. We have all these hidden deep things that are affecting how we live our life. And so one of the ways that we practice our way out of those narratives is by changing the narrative, changing the framework of how we see ourselves. For example, the first practice that I mentioned in the book and go into, and it's something I did it today. I do it pretty much every day is, and I'll tell it in a quick story, which is I was doing a creative project. I couldn't figure it out. I was really frustrated. And I said, under my breath, I said, I'm never going to be a great artist. I said, I'm never going to be a great artist. And I was like, time out. I just made a narrative about myself. Where did that come from? And there's a bunch of things that have could led to that. Like I'm not formally trained as an artist. I've never made gobs of money, never won any awards, things that we equate with success. So I just inwardly started saying, I'm never going to be great, whatever that means for me, right? But I knew I needed to change it. So what I did is I came up with a new phrase to say, which was, I'm on my way to being a great artist. When I move from I'm never going to be to I'm on my way, it changes the timeline of where I think I'm at. It changes the framework of what I think I'm in. I'm on my way means if I quote unquote fail at something, it doesn't mean I'm a failure. It just means I'm learning as I go, which is part of being on your way to something, part of growing into something. When I say I'm never going to be, I've made a statement about what my life is going to turn out like. But when I say I'm on my way, I'm opening myself up to a universe of possibilities. And I'm giving respect and dignity to the place I find myself now. Even if it's incredibly hard and mysterious and seemingly mundane and uneventful, you know, like, which is a lot of moments in our day. I've done a lot of house cleanup and laundry for today, you know, but I go on a plane and I do a show tomorrow. It just, you know, but I can constantly remind myself, like, I'm on my way to something. I'm going somewhere. I'm in that process. And so that's how I changed the trajectory of where I think my life is headed. And then I don't view things as like dead ends. I'm like, whoa, this is something I'm learning on as I go. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense?
It makes complete sense. But you know, to highlight a point there in time, there was a moment where you felt like everything was falling down around you. You felt like your dreams were crashing down, or your dreams had ended, and maybe call it, you feel like you failed, or you feel like you weren't good enough, whatever those feelings were coming in for you. So in those moments, because so many people listening, myself included, have had those moments, sometimes more often than not, where you look around us and you said something that just rang with me, and maybe it won't with anybody else, but you just said, I am this in my life. I'm a husband now. I am a son. I'm a friend. I make a career on selling coffee and talking on podcasts. But you know, the views of success on that, I can find, maybe I've can find many that would say, oh yeah, you've been very successful at that. I could also come up with 1,000 reasons why I failed at all of them.
Exactly.
So in the midst of that, before you even get to the point where you can see that you're on your way, how do you deal with those moments? How do you encourage yourself and others in those moments?
I always want to start with the solidarity of the sucky moment, you know, like some of us were trained to like, don't be so sad, you know, buck up, smile. But like, let's be honest, like if you find yourself in a miserable moment, I get it. And I'm just like, want to say, like, I acknowledge that there are many miserable moments in our life. I'm on my way is important for me because, in my wrestling and working through depression, the time I'm most depressed is when I think nothing's going to change. That's the predominant narrative of depression, is it's always going to stay this way. It's never going to be different. I can never change. Nothing will ever change. And I'm on my way helps break that up. My publisher's going to hate me. I'm just going to give away all the secrets. The second practice, it's not in any specific order. These are just the ways. One of the other one that I do when I find myself in a spot, usually, you know, my misery usually comes from comparison, just because of the culture we live in and the screens and the stuff we participate in. Like I'm always seeing other people's lives and they look way better than mine all the time. And so one of the ways that I can at least dive into where I'm at now is I move from comparison and I just go, I can be a contribution today. I'm a contribution. So I'm on my way and I'm a contribution. I can contribute something today. I can put my love and attention at something and I can be an offering, maybe in simple ways, maybe in big ways. Often big ways come from constantly giving in simple ways. You know what I'm saying? But I'm a contribution helps me to go, I can offer something today to a person, to a work, to an idea, to a community. And that helps ground me in accepting the gift and receiving the gift of myself and what I can uniquely contribute. So that's how I would encourage you or a listener is like, sure. Well, on the path of our life, there are a lot of people going similar directions and they look leaps and bounds ahead of us for sure. You know, you're doing podcasting. I'm sure there's many moments where like, well, they have a lot more downloads than I do, you know, and I am as an artist or a speaker, I'm like, oh, they get a lot bigger audience than I do. Or, you know, they sell, you know, whatever, there's always going to be that. But I think one of my ways of practicing being a contribution is like practice gratitude, just really go, I'm so grateful for the opportunity that I got even to do this, that I can't even do this. You know, there are things within that I'm a contribution, why I can practice gratitude. I fleshed that out in the book a lot, but gratitude really helps starting that, like how to be a contribution and stuff. Is there like a BS call on that? What do you think about that on the contribution end?
Oh, I don't think there's a BS call. I think it's one of the reasons. I think you touch on it perfectly because I think your book Say Yes is something to pick up, because my issue and my question is how hard is it to get there? And then how often can those thoughts slip in? I remember I was thinking here, and it's almost humorous to me now, but I remember this guy. So the thing that comes up to mind for me, we were trying to start my coffee company. I have a coffee company with my buddies. And we're trying to do really good stuff with it. We really are. The heart of Generous is really positive. We're donating 100% of profits to nonprofits. And I thought God was behind us. I thought the world was behind us. And in order to get it started, we had to have capital. And so I agreed to do this appearance at a car dealership. And I was like, I don't want to. It gives me anxiety. I was like, I'm going to do it because it's going to pay to get this company launched.
Yeah.
I think 7 people showed up. I think I was there 3 hours. And I still remember the moment where I looked around me and I went, this has got to be rock bottom. Like this has got to be. And then the second is, and I've heard you tell a similar story and I write about it in my book. And I think it's so important though, is the pivot point for me that my very earliest memory is not being chosen to be a reading partner with anybody in my second grade class. Everybody got to pick partners. I was the only one not chosen. It's affected me since that day. You have a similar story that people can watch and find out about.
Yeah.
And so, you know, for me, one of my constant battles is the comparison and how often can I get myself to a place of contribution? Because sometimes it just never seems clear. It never seems like it's in front of me. It feels like I'm only in a place of comparison, is why I'm gonna read your book. I've already been convinced of that way before this interview, and which is why I'm glad you're here, because thanks. I do think beyond all that, the things that you're saying are true.
Yeah,
it just
works. Well, can I give you an image? This really helps me, and this is in the book version. What is this idea of like how do we kind of know where we would like to go, but we're not always sure how to get there or what it's going to look like. And this has really helped me is to go, imagine you were going to go on a road trip, but you knew you were never going to get to the destination. How would that affect the kind of road trip you would go on? What you would do is you would make the road trip just as enjoyable as getting to the destination. The road trip would be like, I would like to go, like there's probably plenty of ways. I'm just thinking, I grew up on the West Coast, so I'm thinking of like, you can drive the I-5 through California or you can drive the 101, you know, like you can ride the coast and it takes infinitely longer, or you could just do the straight shot through the ugly parts, you know, industrial parts, and just get there. it's, but if you knew you weren't going to get to, like, if you're driving LA to San Francisco and you knew you weren't going to get to San Francisco, would you do the I-5? Maybe because there's an in and out on the way, you know, that's great. Or, but most likely you choose the 101 because you'd be like, I want to make the journey is just as enjoyable. This helps me in like kind of setting our goals somewhere is to go, maybe I need to be open-handed on what this is all supposed to turn out to be. But this, if out of all the journeys I could go on, this sounds like the most interesting one to go on to. Like, I want to try at least to go there because who knows what will happen along the way. I'll get really vulnerable with all of you. Like, I'm learning how to become, I'm still learning as a performing artist. You know, I've been doing it for about 5 years, but I was like, man, when I really think about what I want to do, there's this, I want to try to get to the Fringe Festival. It's this largest theater comedy festival. It's in Edinburgh, Scotland. And I just was like, I have a post-it note right in front of me. It's just like, go there. And I'm just setting my sights to there. I don't know if we'll ever get there. I might get there and nobody likes what I do, you know, because it's a real intense competition there, whatever. I don't care as much as like, that's the journey I want to set myself towards. I think that would be an interesting journey of like learning how to get there, putting it all together. What is the finances? What are the relationships? You know, all these kinds of things. Even though they might be complicated and hard, I'm like, I'd get up in the morning for that. And that's, it's paying attention to the journey that's going to bring you to life. That's the journey you need to go on. Whether you make it all the ways you thought, honestly, nobody knows how that's going to turn out. But you can still apply yourself to the place that's going to bring you to life. I think that's what we need to do.
Hmm. That's great. I'm going to sit on that for a bit. And no, it's I will not call BS on that one. The journey to get there, make it as beautiful, make it as fun. It's been interesting. It's been exciting. It's been hard, but we're all on it and we can all relate on that. Switch gears before the final question, Scott, almost a complete switch of gears, but something I'm just intrigued by. And I wanted to ask you, and I want to take the time for it. I mentioned a friend of ours, that I look up to that. I just went through some, intensive leadership training. He led us through, my buddies and I, through it. And you do training. You mentioned a little bit ago that I'm gonna get the words wrong, but you're trained
spiritual director.
Spiritual director, which I wrote down soul care. I don't know why, but that's what I wrote down.
That's great.
Okay, that works. You work with pastors. You work with leaders on their soul care.
Yeah.
Just for anybody listening that may be in a place of leadership, a place of leadership in their home, at their school, at a church, business. What are some of the things that you've identified in these leaders? What are some of the things that you've noticed, and what's maybe a message for them?
Yeah, a quick definition is, this is the most helpful. If you imagine, okay, so imagine like marriage counseling, and you have like this kind of triad, this like marriage counselor and this couple. The marriage counselor isn't focused on either part of the couple. The marriage counselor is focused on the conversation between the two points, between the two people. They're focused at that middle spot where the conversation is happening. That's what a good marriage counselor does. A spiritual director, in that same way, is in that triad with the divine, the directee, and the director. It's not necessarily focused on like God or the directee. It's focused on what's the conversation that's happening, the two, and how are we kind of bringing the, because, you know, the divine is invisible and infinite and, you know, very mysterious, but like with the directee, they're physically there and we can talk about kind of putting that together. We're focused on that conversation. So the director is just a person who's alongside you and helping point you back to that conversation. I did a couple books with my friend, Justin McRoberts, about prayer. And our real hope was like helping people kind of figure out prayer practices that work for them. But where we started from was that we said that prayer is not getting God's attention. Prayer is awakening to the voice and work of God that's already happening. And I actually believe that a spiritual life is not about getting God's attention. It's about awakening to what's already happening already. We could go back to those graces, like the heartbeat, like the telephone, what's already taking place. I think that's the, you know, those moments in life where you break into tears, it feels like the universe is being intentional with you. Like you get just the smallest glimpse, but you get this little glimpse that like Providence has been walking alongside you the whole time. And that's what I'm trying to practice in my own life and try to practice with others. For those leaders who find themselves, here's the struggle with all of our, whether it's work, spiritual work, artistic work, is that we can get inundated with all the responsibilities that come with that. And what we lose is that deep interior connection to the why of what we're doing. I'm an artist, but I would say that my job is really to be a listener. And there's a longer story about my own career, but I just have always been invited to be a listener. And so part of my practice as an artist during the week is I go on a walk. Like people might think like, well, that's just a luxury. I'm like, no, if I don't do that, I dry up. Like in order to maintain an output, I need an input. And for me, it's walking in the woods here in Austin. Like there's a great walk along the river, along the city. And I need that time. I need that place. I think it's like, what is it we're trying to give to the world? Is like, we have to fill that up in us. And so I would say, I understand we can all get really involved in the tangible things, but we must hold the space for that intimate conversation, the secret life. It's what Jesus, when he talks about prayer, he's like, go into your closet and have a secret conversation. Because when you're in a secret conversation in your closet or your shower, which happens mostly for me, is you're honest and you talk about real things and you're who you are and stuff. So I'm always, you know, when we say like, you got to develop a prayer life, that sounds so unsexy. Like my joke always is like talking about your prayer life is like talking about your ab routine. Like nobody thinks they're killing it. Like nobody's like, I'm killing that. Yeah. Right. We can all feel a lot of shame with it. And so it's like, well, what we need to let go of is what we think it's supposed to look like, and then allow ourselves just to enter into whatever kind of gives us life or we find nurturing. And I really push people to that. Just like, you need to find a space where, even if it's 15 minutes, it's just like you're getting to that connection.
I want to end this by just saying thank you. I don't know how.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
Well, and I don't know how often you hear it, but your desire to dig deep, to look beyond, to ask the questions, to sit in the pain, is something very helpful for so many. Yeah. And we'll mention the resources to pick up Scott's book, Say Yes. We'll also tag all the other things that Scott's worked on. We ask everybody the same question at the end of the podcast. Answer however you want. In fact, one of our most recent guests called BS on the question. Said, nope, not even a good question. I said, okay, that's fair. That's good. Scott, do you believe hope still wins? If so, why? And if not, why not?
Ooh, man, I understand calling BS. I do. I actually, I meet with a spiritual director. His name's Morris. And we were talking yesterday. And out of all the times that I'm like, I don't know if this, you know, if what I'm believing even is right to believe, or is it true or whatever, just like, is the divine, is the almighty involved in our world? A lot of times it looks like not. Is there any way to change the course we find ourselves in? And those are real legitimate questions. I keep finding, I haven't figured out how to perfectly articulate this. So sorry if I'm, a little stumbled, but I was like, I keep finding a power greater than any other power poking its head up every now and then. And it mostly looks like the ability to forgive. Like when I see awful things done to each other, and it just feels like, what a horrible situation. And then there's somebody there. It's like they're tapping into something deeper or larger than the whole thing that we think is the whole thing. And there's this way to like cut all the violence, cut all the things. And there's this like work of forgiveness. And I would say that like, that's the foundation of the kingdom of heaven is forgiveness. I see that every now and then. I do think hope exists. I do think that there is something larger, deeper, however you want to metaphor it, that is beyond all of the powers that you think are the most powerful. And I want to tap into that. I want to keep going towards that. I see it. I don't see it all the time, but every now and then, it surprisingly, I see it come up and I'm like, oh yeah, I forget there's something deeper than all of this that I think there is. And that gives me hope.
Scott Erickson, thank you so much for joining us today. You articulated that very well, by the way, and I've never met anybody named Morris who does not have an extreme amount of wisdom.
I'll let him know that.
Yeah, please tell him that. And when that hope or the Almighty pokes their head up, I'd like to think that's enough. I would like to think that it is worth going after. Scott Erickson, thank you for joining Hopes to Ones. It means a ton.
I'm so glad I got to be with you.
Thank you so much for tuning into today's episode of Hope Still Wins. And if you haven't already, please subscribe or follow the show wherever you listen to podcasts. If you enjoyed this conversation, I think you did, please consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple and join the community over on Instagram at Hope Still Wins. All right, well, that's it for today, my friends. As a reminder, make sure to check out Scott's new book, Say Yes, out now. Thank you again for listening to this episode of Hope Still Wins. I'm your host, Ben Higgins, and do me a favor, let's chat next week.